It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk about a new law that changes the way state government talks about people with intellectual disabilities. First, how worried are you about your privacy in this digital age? There's a lot of technology out there that can put us at risk: our smartphones, personal assistants, social media, online shopping, and business. And look what's coming down the pike: self-driving cars, artificial intelligence, 5G, automation, and facial recognition. Our next guest says we've given up too much control over our digital lives in the high-tech world, and that we need a new federal law, among other things, to take some of it back. Kara Swisher is editor-at-large for the technology news website Recode and producer of the Recode Decode podcast. She wrote an opinion piece about her call for new legislation in the New York Times. Kara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
And you write in that piece, if people are worried now, holy cow, with this stuff coming down the pike, we've got a lot to worry about. What are you watching for?
Well, there's a lot of things. A lot of the new secular trends in tech are really quite large around AI, automation, robotics, changes in driving. And they're much more substantive than what's come before, even though what's come before seems amazing, like the whole mobile revolution and people using cell phones and location-based stuff and apps and everything else. It seems massive, but what's coming is even more massive, and it has much more to do with changing our analog lifestyle at the same time and integrating with our digital lifestyle.
For a lot of people, they are worried, they're concerned about privacy, but I think a lot of people who are casual users, maybe they shop some on Amazon, they post stuff on Facebook, they might not be thinking about this. For that more casual internet user, can you talk about what right now risks there are to their privacy and personal data?
Well, anytime you put data up into the cloud, it's at risk. And, you know, the kind of stuff you share, you're not sort of aware of all the stuff you share, including your location, where you go to, who you call, what you buy, and things like that. And the question, you know, with all these recent crises around Facebook and Google and others and hacking, and just today there was yet another hacking on WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook. You know, everything is at risk that you put out there in the digital ether. You just have to think about every single communication you make.
And you're not just worried about hacking, though. You're worried about legitimate legal companies who have legal, at least right now, legal access to all our stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think hacking is going to be a perennial problem. This is, you know, why do you rob banks? It's where the money is. Why do you rob internet companies? It's because where the data is. And so there's tons and tons of really interesting data, including credit card numbers and things like that, and just general information also about people. But really, these companies are using a lot of that information and mashing it together with all kinds of other information from credit card companies and other companies, and creating this profile of you where they can anticipate things that you want to buy and where you want to go, and, you know, and can manipulate you in ways you never realized. And we saw little bits of that with the election and with the Russians doing it. And so if you think about it, you know, no matter what the controversy is around Russia, they did use these social platforms to manipulate the election, and they used it as customers of Facebook, not as hackers of Facebook.
Now, this wasn't necessarily the original vision of the internet going back 30 years or so. What happened along the way? Did we just sort of fall into this, or were there conscious decisions made that put our privacy at risk?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, these things, as they grow bigger, they get better. And we a lot of ways we can traded convenience for what might have been good. And because it's so convenient to do maps or calls or anything that you do online or order things, it's so convenient. And I think the question is, have we given away too much for the convenience we're getting?
We are talking about privacy in the digital age. Kara Swisher is with us from Recode. She wrote an opinion piece about these issues at the New York Times. Kara, you're looking for, among other things, some kind of legislation, not just piecemeal legislation, something at the federal level. What might that look like?
Well, it depends on what you want to solve. If there's, you know, a national privacy bill would be nice. There's a big one in California. Obviously, Europe has the GDPR, which is the General Data Protection rules. And so we don't have anything on that level here. We just have California, which is has introduced an act that goes into effect in 2020 next year. And then there's about 10 states contemplating different privacy bills, but we don't have a national privacy bill, which is what's needed. And that could include lots of things or not much at all. It just depends on how it's written. You know, it definitely should include, at the very least, when something gets hacked, that you know about it immediately. Companies, how they need to how they need to inform you. The second thing is what they're doing with your data, and whether you're giving permission to give it to third parties. There's all kinds, they can make it any way they want, you know, but the question is how much is it going to protect consumers and how much is it going to protect the current incumbents and keep their stranglehold on our data.
You mentioned that European law, you're not a big fan. You think that may go a little too far?
No, I'm not a big fan. I think it's great law. I think it's just there's some parts of it that I don't like. But like the right to be forgotten, I think, is impossible in this country with the First Amendment. You know, it's a little they're a little further on privacy. But the general direction is correct. In other countries like New Zealand and Australia, and New Zealand just had a terrible tragedy with, when social media, you know, was put to bad use. There was a whole murder broadcast on social media. And so in Christchurch. And so they are also looking at different ways to rein in these companies, and not just via rules, but also banning, for example, in Sri Lanka. There's all kinds of different things happening. The FTC in this country is contemplating a fine on Facebook for breaking a consent decree it agreed to many, many years ago and has broken many times. And so there's all kinds of ways to deal with this.
Now, in your piece, you quote someone else who's taken the opposite view on this issue, saying, hey, if you don't like it, if you're worried about your privacy, mm-hmm. you can just opt out. Don't use Google, Amazon, the list goes on. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as a valid option?
Oh, it's like the guy who said that was the original guy, Scott McNeely, who said, you have no privacy, get over it. That was 20 years ago he said that, and he was absolutely correct. That doesn't mean you don't have control over your data. I think he was being rather cavalier. He's like, I have no secrets. I've got nothing. But it doesn't take into account how much our life has become digitized. And you do, you know, it's like saying don't use a car or don't use a telephone or don't use electricity. These things are part of everyday life, and it's very hard to operate without at least some glancing involvement into some internet-related thing. And so you shouldn't have to use these services and then be subject to all their whims. You should be able to use them, and in a fair way, they take a certain amount of economic benefit from you, but you should know about it, and it shouldn't treat you like the fuel to their business model.
I'm going to look at one of the cutting-edge pieces of technology you touched on earlier and dig a little more into the possibilities. Facial recognition software. We keep seeing this pop up in the news again and again. First of all, what can we do right now, and how is it being used, you know, in this day and age?
Well, there's different things. Look, they're doing stuff in China that's way beyond the pale that would be allowed in this country, although who knows if some of it's being deployed. You know, the idea is to follow people around everywhere they are and then to recognize them by their faces. You know, some police departments are using these in order to find criminals. Some there's been used in jobs here sometimes where they track your face to the face of top performers and companies. There's all kinds of different things you could apply it to. The question is, do we want to do that? Do we want people to be tracked by their face? It's pretty dystopian when you think about it. And the ways it's being applied in China are disturbing, to say the least, including singling out different ethnic minorities there. So, you know, it can go. We don't want to be in an arms race on facial recognition with China. That's not really the bar we want to.
And one thought on facial recognition is I might think, okay, I went into this store, I didn't buy anything, I didn't join their loyalty club, I didn't use a credit card, whatever, so they don't know. But with facial recognition advanced enough, mm-hmm. they might still know that I was in the store looking at whatever I was looking at.
Yeah, exactly. And they, you know, there's also racial profiling. It just is so open to so much abuse. You know, in terms of what does a criminal look like, what is, you know, you can even just right now, you can go on Google and look up CEO and it's always a white guy. Is that the case? Should that be the case? Why is that our imagery of it? Because those are the images. And so the question is, how much control do we want to have over our personhood compared to digital abilities to find us and to locate us and to put us in a database? It's just really, these are questions we need to be asking. Maybe we decide, yeah, sure, we want a database. We want to be safer. But you definitely know it's going to lead to a lot of, you know, what they call dirty data, which is data that doesn't really tell a story. It's just, it tells the story the person who's collecting it wants to, but not necessarily the real story.
You're bringing up these questions. Do you think enough people in the right places are bringing up these questions?
Well, you know, Congress has got to really think about this hard. And, you know, this administration's not particularly interested in science or technology. And so they haven't been focused on this very much whatsoever, actually, because there's all kinds of job implications. They should be. But, you know, Congress is sort of a little bit around the edges, but mostly just hearings. I mean, I think most of the activity is outside this country. But these are critical issues because, you know, most of these companies are U.S.-based companies. And the U.S. needs to deal with what it's invented and figure out where it wants to go next and what kind of strictures it wants to put on these companies, because they are in a lot of ways like nation states, right? They have so much information on us and so much ability to track us and know what we want and anticipate our needs. And, you know, it just calls, just like every other big regulatory, every other big industry like cars or chemicals or anything else, needs some guidelines.
We're talking about the loss of our digital privacy. Kara Swisher stays with us. She's editor-at-large for the technology news website Recode. She wrote a New York Times opinion piece and says we need to take back control of our digital lives. That should include some kind of federal law. Specifics she'd leave to Congress, but she says there needs to be something. We'll go to your calls now. Josh starts us off in Milwaukee. Josh, hi.
Hi. It's great to speak with you, Rob. Hi, Kara.
Hi.
My question has to do, I've seen some proposals about actually having some form of tax on companies collecting our data and then storing our data and transferring our data. I kind of want to get your thoughts on doing that. Governments tend to be very efficient at collecting taxes. So rather than trying to do a search and find, making it valuable, plus it changes the kind of the relationship between us as a user and the companies collecting our data.
Interesting, Josh. Right. What do you think, Kara?
Yeah, that's by Amy Klobuchar, actually. Senator Klobuchar from Minnesota is the one that's been proposing this idea in order to do a tax on data, either data violations or the data itself, and then use that money to fund more investigative work by the FTC and other government agencies charged with these companies, charged with regulating these companies. And the question is, what do we charge and what do we charge for? The data they collect, the data they sell, the data, you know, it's really a complicated issue. It's not a bad idea. It's just how do you put it out there? And the second part is, maybe you should be paid as a consumer for the data you give. Why not? Why shouldn't you get a piece of that? And I guess if the taxpayers are getting it, you're getting it. But it's a question of where the money is going to go and how they're going to do it, and what precisely gets taxed every time you click or what. And so it's an interesting idea. It just depends on how they execute it.
Josh, thanks a lot for that call. And it raises the idea of should we make money off of it? Raises almost a philosophical question, Kara. Do we own our data? Is our data part of us?
Yeah, of course it is. It's just that you also don't get to sell your kidney easily, right? You know what I mean? It's just like, should you be able to give up your privacy? Is that something for sale? That's a good question.
Let's go to another caller at 800-642-1234. Ted is with us in West Allis. Ted, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Ted?
Well, you know, I think your guest is touching on a whole lot of issues that I seem to live with on a daily basis. I guess I'm what I would probably call a functioning Luddite. I have a cell phone. I have a it has some capabilities. I've got a laptop, and I guess what annoys the heck out of me is when my phone is constantly updating itself on apps that I never use, and I don't have any control over what it is doing. And I guess it kind of does show how we are kind of like sitting ducks. And like I think the guest mentioned earlier, too, I mean, I have no idea how to opt out of most of what I'm, you know, probably opting into.
Ted, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, and as Ted's saying, in some cases, he's not even opting in. It just shows up on his phone.
In that case, I don't know what kind of phone he has. I'd love to know what kind of phone he has. If it's an Apple phone, you can actually turn off updates. They won't update if you don't want them to. There are certain things you can turn on and off. On some of the other phones, that's not possible. But in most of the new smartphones, you can control what gets updated and what doesn't. But, you know, by their very nature, apps are always improving themselves and adding things, including, you know, more safety protections. Like today on WhatsApp, you had to download a security feature that would stop people from hacking your phone. So that's kind of a good update to get. Although the fact that it's doing that in the first place is troublesome enough. I think the question is, it's not, none of it's in plain English. None of it's done in a way that people do understand. And it's so complexified that people don't understand precisely what they're giving away and what they agree to in order to get very simple services like maps and or to put photos up to show to families. I mean, in many cases, you don't realize you're also giving the copyright to those companies in a way, although you still retain the copyright. It's all different depending on which app, and you shouldn't have to wade through them, you know, like you're a lawyer if you're not a lawyer.
Ted, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about digital privacy threats to it and what can be done to fix it. Kara Swisher is with us from the website Recode. code. Kara, even for people who do think they're opting out, I understand that you may not believe in Facebook, but Facebook believes in you. Even if you don't participate, they may well have a file based on other stuff people do.
Yeah, sure do. They sure do. They have all kinds of ways to find you on the internet. You know, they have enough people there. They have 2.6 billion people. And so you either interact with someone who's on Facebook or you do that every day. So it's very hard to hide from any of these companies, whether it's Google or Facebook or, you know, Amazon, you kind of have to use. You have to use some part of it. And Apple, you have to buy the devices. But a lot of the other ones are sort of, you know, just embedded into so much stuff, it's hard to avoid them.
Let's go to another caller now. Meg is with us in Montello. Meg, hi.
Hi there. I have identical twin boys. They're actually in their 30s now, so they're young men, or men, actually. And Facebook thinks that they're both the same person. They will tag one as the other all the time. So if you think about the implications of that, it's not infallible. And, you know, as this database of people's things are being made, mistakes could be made.
Meg, thanks for the call. As a fellow parent of identical twins, I'll be watching for that one.
Wow, that's interesting. I mean, you know, it's probably because of facial recognition. They probably can't figure that out. You know, I think most people do. They do know different identities based on people's movements throughout the digital system. You know, they can really track you in ways you don't even understand. But that's an interesting issue of you know, another wrinkle of facial recognition. I don't see any good coming out of facial recognition in general.
Meg, thanks for the call. We got an email from Jackie in Wanakee who's asking about the personal assistants, the Alexas and Siris and whatnot. Should we be worried about eavesdropping, human listening, or whatever's being done with just the stuff we say around our device?
You want me to say that? Yeah, you know, I think there's a question. Just recently in Google, they had added a camera they didn't tell you about into their Nest thermostats. You know, they have things that fire alarms and things like that. And of course, Ring is owned by Amazon now, and that's a doorbell kind of thing, and cameras in your home. And so they're all there recording all the time. And in many cases, it's just most of them are just turn on when you say a certain word, but they pick up little, someone just wrote a great piece of the little bits of information they pick up when they're just sitting there. I don't think they're meaning to send information back to these companies, but they can. That's the thing. They can. Like anytime you can do something, it seems like humanity does it. And so that's the big problem is that, you know, who's running these companies some years from now? What if there's a hacking? What if there's a software glitch? It just leads to, I turn all of mine off. My kids unplug them constantly, the ones we have in our home, because outside of your home, I suppose it's okay if they're just pointing outwards at people outside and in front of your home to protect it. But anything pointing inside of your home is subject to hacking or misuse, I think.
Let's bring on one more caller. Owen is with us in Wyawega. Owen, hello.
Yeah, good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, you know, the more I hear about this stuff, the more anxiety it creates. You know, you just, well, for instance, Lisa's phone yesterday got all these calls over and over from Israel. And we had just been getting some messages coming in on an email from a different company. And I don't know if that's all connected or not. But then this morning I wake up to hearing about Israel's got some sort of new way of hacking into people's information, and I don't know, it's very scary, so I don't know, maybe we just need to get rid of technology altogether and go back and become Amish.
Owen, thanks for the call. Now, Kara, I know you're worried about this stuff, but you're not giving up technology altogether, though.
No,
you may share some of
know.
Owen's anxiety. What's an everyday person to do?
I don't know if Owen was Amish in the first place, but that's okay. You know, you're not going to go backwards because some of these things are amazing. Would you go planes, even though they have all kinds of carbon footprints that are so dangerous to this world, or cars, same thing? Or, you know, there's all kinds of trade-offs we make when we use technology of all kinds. And so the question is, what are the right safeguards of them? And the one he was referring to, it wasn't Israel is spying on it. This Israeli firm has found some hacking problems having to do with WhatsApp. And so, you know, these things are global in nature. And so you have to think about how connected we are. And the more connected we are, especially digitally, the more prone it is to hacking, the more prone it is to abuse, the more prone it is that people can find you anywhere you are. And so the more we add to it, not just facial recognition, but sensors and DNA tracking and all kinds of things, eye tracking and you know, the more we can, it's sort of like the movie The Matrix, the more we get jacked into the system, the more we are the network. And so it doesn't mean we shouldn't use it. I think some of this stuff is just miraculous and really amazing that can connect people all over the globe in a commonality. But unfortunately, a lot of what's happened is we notice our differences, the partisanship, the bickering, the stuff that goes on Twitter. You know, it's like a cesspool of humanity. And the question is, what can we do better with these amazing technologies?
We'll leave it there for now, Kara. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Kara Swisher, editor-at-large for the technology news website Recode and producer of the Recode Decode podcast. We talked with her about her call for a federal law, among other things, aimed at protecting people's digital privacy. She wrote a piece on that in the New York Times opinion section. You can check that out at the New York Times website, and you can keep sharing your thoughts with us if you're willing to share them on the internet. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Governor Evers signed his first piece of legislation 2 weeks ago, a law that replaces the phrase mental retardation in state administrative code with intellectual disability. The legislation had bipartisan support, though there was some frustration on the Republican side with Evers. Republican Representative John Jagler in the Assembly and Republican Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald in the Senate had each introduced similar bills in their respective chambers, but Evers also signed an executive order in March calling for similar change. Republicans say he missed an opportunity to work along with them. Leah Kitz joins us now for a look at the impact of the changes, whoever they came from. She's Executive Director of Disability Rights Wisconsin. That's a nonprofit organization protecting the rights of people with disabilities around the state. Leah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, good afternoon.
Well, can you explain a little more what this law actually changes?
It actually changes rules and regulations in Wisconsin. There have already been changes in the federal laws, changes in the state statutes, and now this takes it all the way to the rules and regulations. And so what it does is take the words mental retardation or related type of terminology and replaces it with individuals with intellectual disabilities.
And why was this an important change?
It's important because first of all, it's a term that really is not used anymore in parlance of talking with people with disabilities because of the perception that it carries with it. When somebody uses that term now, they're not speaking, they're not providing a diagnostic type term that's no longer used. They're taking a term and putting a negative connotation on it. And so, you know, if somebody calls somebody else, a friend or somebody, and the R word, when they call them that, they're not meaning it as a compliment. they're meaning it as some sort of insult or that the person's acting silly or something like that. And so it just catches up the current regulatory language to the current usage of the language. Professionally and in everybody's lives.
And are you hoping that this kind of change, in this case the administrative code, can have a trickle-down effect in our everyday usage of words related to what was formerly called mental retardation?
It can. You know, if you look back over time, there are, you know, language changes for many groups over time. It has to do with perception. But usually when terminology is first introduced or first starts being used, it's done so in a professional way, in a way to try to categorize or describe something. So many of the terms that we commonly use even today as insults were at one time meant to describe or categorize people and their learning abilities or their processing abilities. For instance, imbecile was one of the earlier terms that was used. Moron, cretin, idiot, those were all terms to describe people, feeble-minded, people who have difficulty learning or different processing for learning. And those kinds of terms are no longer applied, of course, in a professional setting or in a professional way to categorize people, those terms are only used to describe somebody who, you know, you're attempting to insult. And so because that it's only used in a negative way, it reflects on the people who it was originally describing. And so we try to move along from those terms over time.
Right. So when you put it like that, it sounds like we have a great talent, unfortunately, for taking terms used to describe different intellectual disabilities and turning them into stigmatizing insults. Is there a way to uncouple that? Can we have a cultural change where we don't keep turning words around that way?
That is an excellent question, because over time you have to keep updating your terminology because of how these things happen. And so, not only are the terms changed, but our perceptions of people and what they need and how they are as part of our society, that has also changed over time. We had, before the turn of the last century, so in the late 1800s, people with what is now called intellectual or developmental disabilities, there were different perceptions of them, some being that they were sort of angelic and held a special place, but they could maybe learn, and so you wanted to put schools together to sort of help them. But as the turn of the century started, as the century started turning, those perceptions changed, and that had to do with some of the Darwin's theories. It wasn't his theories themselves so much, but people's applications of those theories. And the applications were to look at, can we use the process of genetics to create a perfect race? Well, if you're looking at perfect race, that means that some are not perfect because they don't, contain all the elements that you believe are perfect. And so over time, this became the way the perception of people who had differences, especially learning differences. But not only that, some of it was racial, and there were other things, and that there was a problem with them. They were a problem with society. So now what we need to do is, first of all, stop them from having more people, babies, and also separate them from society so that they don't cause problems for society. That was the beginning of some of the institutional care, forced sterilization, and different things. And the terminology for that was eugenics. And that carried on for quite a while. That eventually changed to a medical model where we were looking at people like, what can we do to either prevent these things from happening, people getting disabilities, or treat them. And so people were, involved with a lot of medical research and things like that through the 50s and 60s. But during that whole time, people were still being put in institutional settings, large institutional settings. And over time, society's perception again changed, started to view people as, individuals, part of our families, part of our communities. And why are we putting them there? And shouldn't they be part of our everyday lives? I remember growing up hardly ever seeing people with disabilities in my community. And now they're in part of all of our lives and have enriched all of our lives. The only way I think that the negative connotation really changes is when we really perceive people and welcome people, all people, as part of our lives, and that they add layers and textures and ideas and perceptions that we wouldn't have thought of, or that make us see things in a different way. And so I think the only way we get past the negative connotation, where we have to keep changing terminology, is in part to bring people, to view us all as an interesting woven fabric of society.
And Leah, in our last couple minutes, I want to getting to the language again. I've heard the idea of a person-first language or person-centered language, that instead of describing somebody as a category like imbecile once was, or talking about a disabled person, using going person-first to remind us that we're talking about individuals.
Yes, thank you. I didn't realize I was kicked so long on the other thing. Yes, absolutely. People want to be referred or thought of as the person, not the diagnosis or not the problem. And so, but that isn't true for everybody. Some people really own who they are and they want to put it out there. But for the most part, you want to start with, you know, not the autistic person, but the person with autism, not the wheelchair-bound person, but the person who is using a wheelchair. You know, terminology like that, that starts with the person, and that's what people first language means.
So are you, as we wrap up, Leah, encouraged by this maybe small change in Wisconsin's state administrative code?
Very, very encouraged. Yes, I think it's great. And it got a lot of celebration in the circles and advocates around the state and family members of people with disabilities and people with disabilities themselves. It was a very popular move, and we were very happy that it was done.
Leah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Leah Kitz is the Executive Director of Disability Rights Wisconsin. We talk with her about a new law that changes the way people with intellectual disabilities are described in Wisconsin Administrative Code. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. military is apparently ready to send a substantial number of troops to the Middle East should Iran take action against American forces. The New York Times reports that the Defense Department presented an updated plan last week. It would call for sending up to 120,000 troops to the region if Iran were to attack the U.S. or if it sped up development of nuclear weapons. That's approaching the size of the American force that have invaded Iraq in 2003. This morning at the White House, President Trump dismissed the reporting.
I think it's fake news, okay? Now, would I do that? Absolutely. But we have not planned for that. Hopefully, we're not going to have to plan for that. And if we did that, we'd send a hell of a lot more troops than that.
Meanwhile, Iran says the U.S. is playing, quote, a very dangerous game, end quote, as it tries to drag the country into what Iran called an unnecessary war. Eric Schmidt is a senior writer covering terrorism and national security for the New York Times. He also co-wrote the report about the U.S. military plans for Iran. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll talk about your reporting. What was the context? Who were the stakeholders involved in crafting this plan to potentially send 120,000 troops to the Middle East?
Well, obviously, this comes against the backdrop of increasing tensions between Iran and the United States. And it also comes as the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, who's known for his hawkish views on Iran, basically asked the Pentagon to come in and brief him and other senior administration officials last Thursday at the White House on what the state of military contingency planning was should the Iranians attack the United States. And again, the U.S. has claimed that there's new intelligence out there over a week ago that indicates that Iran or its proxies in Iraq or Syria could attack United States troops. So the what's happened, though, in the last several years is with the drawdown of American forces in Iraq and in other places in the Middle East, the question becomes how quickly and with what kind of forces could the Pentagon respond to any kind of attack on American troops or ships in that region?
Now, one thing that this plan did not include, it sounds like, was an actual direct land invasion of Iran. Is that right?
That's correct. The way it was explained to me and by my sources was this is a plan that essentially helps defend American allies in the region against an Iranian attack, and also to help United States defeat the Iranian nuclear program should they, as you indicated, speed up dramatically from where it is today. But it does not call for a land invasion, which would require many, many more forces.
Now, President Trump, as we just heard there, denied or disagreed with the report, but said, yeah, he would do that and more. What do you make of the president's response to your reporting?
Well, the president clearly hasn't been briefed on this yet. As we indicated, this is something that says at the very preliminary stages right now, basically because this new threat stream has come in and the American administration officials are concerned about it. So Mr. Bolton, who's the National Security Advisor, convened a meeting of top security officials last Thursday to get at least an initial briefing on where the military planning stood and basically to revalidate a long-standing plan the United States military has had on how to respond to threats from Iran. But it does not appear, as we indicated in our story, that the president has yet been briefed on this. And it would be a surprise, frankly, if the president did go ahead with this, because, of course, one of his main themes is how to draw down American forces in the Middle East, draw down from places like Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. So then it's very, very unclear whether he would approve such a an increase. And I have to emphasize that the 120,000 force is the kind of the uppermost option right now that they were considering at this meeting.
Now, one concern that Europeans, among others, have raised could be this scenario. The United States doesn't necessarily want a war with Iran. Iran doesn't want a war with the United States. But there might be enough moving parts and elements that aren't in direct control of either country that could bungle us into a war. What are people talking about?
Well, that is a big concern. Obviously, it was mentioned yesterday by British and other officials. But it's a big concern that people I talk to at the Pentagon and the military commanders, too, they worry about an accidental skirmish escalating to something much larger, with the Iranians now feeling the bite of economic sanctions, increasingly tight sanctions that the U.S. and allies have been putting on it. There's a concern even in the Pentagon that these sanctions have gone too far, and that what you'll see now, particularly as these waivers on different countries allowing them to buy Iranian oil have been cut off, that you're backing the Iranians into a corner and they'll lash out. Now, it may not be, you know, a direct military confrontation. Over the weekend, there were several oil tankers off the coast of the United Arab Emirates that were attacked or were sabotaged. And it's unclear what happened here. The Iranians say they didn't do it. The U.S. government says it's likely they did, but how they did this is still very much in dispute and no evidence has been put forward. So it's an incident like that that somehow could escalate into something much greater that I think has a lot of people here in Washington concerned.
Talking to Eric Schmidt from The New York Times about the U.S. And its relations with Iran and risks of military confrontations. And Eric, one element that some people point to, well, two really, proxies of Iran, non-state groups that Iran backs, or elements of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's Navy, apparently not necessarily completely under the control of the Revolutionary Guard, maybe taking action on their own that could escalate.
That's right. You have Iranian-trained and equipped militias, essentially proxy forces, Shia groups that are in Iraq and Syria, for instance. These are forces that could be employed by the regime. As you mentioned, you have the IRGC, which is kind of a military wing of the government, separate from the Iranian military. That's much more hawkish and has been involved in skirmishes in the past in the Persian Gulf with American naval vessels. And so these are some of the actors that the U.S. intelligence agencies and the military worry about could instigate some kind of attack.
Now, we had this nuclear deal with Iran. Obviously, not everyone loved it. President Trump among them and John Bolton. But did that give a framework for negotiation and diplomacy that is maybe lacking now that the U.S. has pulled out? Iran's talking about violating some elements of it now that the U.S. has pulled out.
Well, certainly that was the argument the architects of this made, both back in the Obama administration and its partners in this in Europe and such, and that basically you're focusing on the most serious threat, that is the nuclear threat that Iran posed, and this puts severe constraints on their ability to enrich fissile material that could be used in a nuclear weapon. It capped this and basically bought the international community time in which they hoped that maybe there would be a change in government by the Iranian people during that period. President Trump came in, of course, and called that deal one of the worst he's ever seen and pulled the U.S. out of it. We're now in this kind of interim period where the Europeans have stayed in, but the United States has basically given customers out there, international customers, a choice. You either, the Europeans a choice, you either stick with us and pull out, you know, along with us, or you face the possibility of the United States leveling sanctions against you as well. And most international companies are not going to, you know, the market, you know, they'll look, which market do you want to stay in, the American market or the Iranian market? And they're pulling out of the Iranian market because they don't want to lose the American one.
We've seen Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida say he supports the Trump administration's decision to move military equipment so far to the Persian Gulf region, a carrier, aircraft carrier, among others, I believe. What else are we seeing from members of Congress in the White House handling of Iran?
Well, I think you've seen it lined up more or less along partisan lines, where you have Republicans praising the steps that the administration has taken so far, steps that the administration assert are defensive in nature and are meant to be a deterrent to any kind of Iranian threat. The president and others have said they do not wish to have a war with Iran. But Democrats in Congress say this is exactly what people like John Bolton, his hawkish advisor, maybe a little bit out of sync with the president on this, is exactly where is leading the nation, is to an unintended war, perhaps, or at least a military conflict of some sort with Iran in the Gulf. So it's shaping up along partisan lines, not to any real surprise here in Washington these days.
So what are the next meetings or developments that you're watching for in the next few weeks?
Well, clearly on the ground, we're watching to see what happens in the Gulf itself. In the region, you have this. You have these military forces flowing in. You have an aircraft carrier, other naval forces that are there. You have these bombers coming in that are again meant to be a show of deterrence. We'll be watching to clearly see what happens to any kind of commercial shipping. Will there be more incidents involving tankers being attacked or sabotaged, whether it's in the Persian Gulf or the Red Sea? Any other type of attacks going there? Obviously, we'll watch and see what European actors are doing. We'll watch President Rouhani of Iran has given the Europeans about 60 days basically to help turn around the American position on this, or else he's threatened to resume enrichment of some of the fissile material that they can make nuclear weapons with, and that would mark another escalation. And again, stepping a step by Iran, that is to move away from the nuclear deal that was struck in 2015. Up till now, the Iranians and the Europeans have basically said, let's try and wait out this administration and hope a democratic administration is elected in the United States next year, a democratic administration that would re-embrace the terms of the nuclear deal. But now that resolve is starting to fray on all ends.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Eric Schmidt, senior writer covering terrorism and national security at the New York Times. We talked to him about the Defense Department's reported plan to deploy up to the upper limit, 120,000 troops to the Middle East if Iran were to attack the United States or speed up work on nuclear weapons and uranium enrichment. The Times says the plan does not include a land invasion, though, of Iran. The Milwaukee Bucks are going to the Eastern Conference Finals. That's bringing a lot of attention, national attention, to the team. But at least one online news site is a little confused about where exactly they're from. The website Axios posted a map of the U.S. with the four remaining NBA playoff team logos superimposed on it. Golden State and the Trail Blazers are both shown in the ballpark of San Francisco and Portland, respectively. The Toronto Raptors look like they've migrated across the border into Pennsylvania or upstate New York. And the Milwaukee Bucks on this map, well, they are in the southeastern part of a Midwestern state, but that state is Minnesota. The Bucks logo shows up on top of Minnesota, a little bit of western Wisconsin, and a bit of Iowa. It's gotten some attention from Wisconsinites on Twitter. Rob Thomas of the Capital Times newspaper puts himself in the mindset of the map maker. I could take the time to look up which one Wisconsin is, but I'm pretty sure it's one of these three. Some other comments I saw, maybe the Bucks were stopping at Mayo Clinic for a quick checkup. Another one, can't wait to watch those playoff games at the La Crosse Center. And I always enjoy the scenic drive to Winona, Minnesota to go see the Milwaukee Bucks play. We'll talk about the next round of the playoffs for the Bucks tomorrow on Central Time at 4:15. The championship series kicks off tomorrow night in Milwaukee, the actual Milwaukee in its usual place. This is Central Time.